Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest installment of Baldur's Blatherings, the podcast where Mary and I shine a light on the curious, shadowy, and often very magical history of the Scottish Borderlands. Mary, I believe you've just come back from holiday.
I have indeed come back from holiday, yes.
Where the heck did you go?
I decided not to break my leg this year. So I didn't go up a ladder, but I went all the way up to the Shetland Islands.
Oh.
And I have stories to tell about that.
You have? Oh, that fits well then, because although we are Borders Blatherings and we think in terms usually of the Scottish Borders, I thought today we could have a good old blather about some of the borders we have crossed.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, Shetland's all fit into that, yeah.
And as you've just been on holiday, that would be a perfect idea. How do you feel about that?
Let's go for it. Let's see what we all have to say.
Now, our holiday plans changed, I'm afraid to say, and we have visitors coming to us.
Okay.
So what I thought I could do, if you don't mind, is maybe go back to a time in my life when borders were of particular importance to me.
Okay, that sounds intriguing. Tell me more.
I'll tell you a little bit more before we move on to your recent holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My first thought was not to talk about a border that is drawn on a map, not a physical border.
Right.
But way back in the very early 1990s, I think 1991, I went over to live and work in Turkey. Turkey. I shall call it Turkey.
Right, okay. For the non-Turkish speakers in the audience
if
and myself.
If people don't mind. And this was a small project that was part of a major development called the Anadolu or GAP project.
Right.
And that was formalized around 89.
Okay.
Now, the GAP project, if you're not aware, centered on the building of dams and irrigation.
Right.
It was a sustainability plan of the Turkish government at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an impact on agriculture within the south of the Turkey. So myself and three other people were employed to teach English, basically, as a subplot in this plan.
Right.
And this covered major urban areas from southern Anatolia, Anadolu, down to near the Syrian border.
Mm-hmm.
So a far cry from Istanbul, very much. And this was brokered through the education and agriculture ministries. To try and explain this very quickly to you, what we were employed to do is to work with false beginners in English, people who could introduce themselves in English, people who could tell others where they lived.
Right.
But over an 18-month period, the idea was to get these people to university in America, typically Texas A&M, where they would pass a TOEFL exam so their English was at high enough level to get them into an American university, go through their qualification, then come back to Turkey, and act as a go-between between local farmers and the experts coming in Australia, from New Zealand, from Britain.
Sure.
That was the plan. And so four of us were dispatched to the south.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before this took place, we assembled in Istanbul. And it took, if I remember well enough, it took 4 to 6 weeks to actually get us way down to the southeast of Turkey.
Oh.
There would have been political issues, bureaucratic issues, going on. But eventually it happened. In that 4 to 6 weeks, I had picked up a lot of cultural things from the, shall we say, relatively affluent Turkish people I met living in Istanbul. And so when I arrived in the southeast of the country, I meet a very, very different class of people.
Oh, right, okay.
And I had been actively discouraged from thinking in terms of Kurdistan. You know, they said to me, no, the Kurds, they're not Kurd, they are Mountain Turks.
Oh, okay.
I would hear the word Maganda.
Uh-huh.
You know, these others. And as I learned more and more, I begin really to develop an empathy with the Kurdish people.
Uh-huh.
And I befriended many. And I think the empathy came from similarities, I could say, between the way Scottish people had, especially Highland people, had been treated in history. There were similarities with the way the Kurds were treated.
Uh-huh.
It was very interesting. The banning or restrictions on their language, their culture, the way they dressed.
Yeah.
The naming Mountain Turks. Do you remember the North British?
The North British, of course.
So I began to see a lot of parallels between the situation the Kurds were in, reflecting back on the history of Scotland. And interestingly enough, when many people found out that I was from Scotland, that was important to them. That opened doors.
Right.
They would often say, oh, you're from Scotland, you're not English.
Ah, so they made that distinction.
At first, that was rather strange for me. I didn't actually see that coming. And so I learned a lot about the situation they lived in, and I could often just relate that back to so my empathy was natural, I think. However, those things, when I talked about that, when I eventually moved back to Istanbul to live, and we'll come to that later, I would often mention that I discovered the music of a folk singer called Ahmet Kaya.
Uh-huh.
But they would look at me askance if I name-dropped him.
Oh.
This is music, Kurdish music, that I had learned to love while I lived down there.
Right.
And the middle class, if I can call them, talks about no, we hate him.
And again, there are parallels. When I was in the 80s in Glasgow, I was a big member of the Glasgow folk scene. And it was not trendy to like Scottish folk music.
Mm-hmm.
It was not, you know, you could like the Corries a little bit, but it really was, you like folk music? So the trendy thing, the modern thing, the urban thing was not to really like folk music at
all. The old finger in the ear nonsense.
Interesting parallels.
Well, you know, talking about, I remember I learned this phrase, talking about Ahmet Kaya. The only drug that is taken through the ears is Ahmet Kaya. And I fell in love with his music. It's similar to much Scottish music. It's all about death, loss, the homeland.
Folk music's never pretty.
It's never pretty. And I think he died around, the turn of this, around the year 2000. And he died in France. He went into exile. It was a self-imposed exile. In fact, another parallel with the modern world was he was sentenced to, he was given a prison sentence in absentia when he was living in Paris for anti-Turkish propaganda. It later emerged that all the evidence had been fabricated. What's new kind of thing. I have to say that living in that part of the world just gave me that great empathy, and I felt I was crossing a cultural identity border, a language border, that didn't exist on a map. To many of the high hegems, if I can call them that, in Ankara and Istanbul, Kurdistan didn't exist. And that was a great time in my life. Living conditions were not good. You know, I was living amongst the people, hot water once a week, and it was that kind of thing. But it was a glorious experience of actually crossing a border.
And these were people that had been pushed to the border in Turkish society.
Yeah.
So, yeah, see, borders... Yeah. Borders can mean so many different things to so many different people.
Absolutely.
And I always find one of the issues with the border is who's in charge of a border? Because it's always a juicy, it's the high agents that decide where the border is on the map,
yeah.
or who is in or out to the in crowd, you know, so you're, you know, Kurdistan, mm. no, sorry, you're not part of it, you're on the border, you're pushed out. So yeah, that's interesting. And as you say, there are so many parallels with, especially Scots up in the Gaeltacht. So, interesting travels.
There would have been a time, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I was with a student in the good old days, you know, looking out from the battlements of Edinburgh Castle, we'd say the Firth of Forth.
Yeah.
And I would often say to them that in days gone by, that was in a sense a border, that it represented a, not a defined border that ran through Scotland, but a cultural border.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
They don't need to be on a line, you know, drawn on a map.
I mean, things like the Great Glen in Scotland, everything to the north and west of the Great Glen, that's it. Yeah. You know, so yeah, there are these borders, the borders of language, borders of culture, borders of custom. And they don't, and one of the issues is that they often don't follow political borders, which is often an issue when colonial powers decide to start, you know, drawing borders on maps. They don't follow natural landscape borders or cultural or linguistic borders. And if you then have a people living in your political land, such as Kurds living in Turkey, then it becomes awkward and difficult and, oh, well, just they don't exist.
Yeah.
As you got in Britain with it, well, it was North Britain. They weren't really Scots, they were just North British.
Often reminded me of that, this classification of not quite.
Yeah, not quite. Yeah, so the best thing you could do if you were Scots was to go down to England and become anglicised.
Yeah.
The best thing you can do as a Kurd, presumably, is to go to Istanbul and become Turkish.
Yes.
Those are your best prospects. So you're crossing, is it an internal cultural border that you have to cross to get on in life? Is that what the Kurdish people have to do? Because it's certainly what a lot of Scots did. There's a reason Glasgow is covered with people called MacDonald and MacGregor, because that's what you had to do to survive.
Yeah. And as I work in the minefield that is language. Listening today, I thought that people, there is, to the radio, there is a difference between the public interest and what people are interested in.
Oh, that's a massive difference.
Can someone wake up to this fact?
Yes.
But that whole thing. So I think my to use an allusion to an ex-prime minister whose name I shall not mention. I think my empathy towards the Kurds was in a sense baked in, or priced in. The first time a friend, someone I got to know well, took out an instrument called the saz, which is a stringed instrument, the Kurdish instrument, and started to play and sing a Kurdish song. Although that was frowned upon up in Ankara and Istanbul, it took me back to some of the Scottish music. There was very much a connection there.
Yeah, and again, you had things like the Statues of Iona, where folk tales and folk songs were banned. The telling of tales in Gaelic was banned. The language was gone. Yeah,
the linguistic imperialism and the discouragement or outright banning of dress codes and so on.
Yeah,
it was very similar.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough of that, I think. But do bear in mind that the only drug taken through the ear is Amit Kaya.
I shall have to go and look out his music when we finish our podcast.
And you may not understand a word he's singing about, but one album I would recommend is Benny Bull, which is It's You I Fight. And it's just a wonderful it's just a wonderful album.
That's definitely good. I always like to learn something new in our podcast, so I've learned something new today.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
But that said, to echo Laura Kunzberg, that said, what about your more recent holiday? Because I'm way back in the early 1990s.
But. Well, there are similarities here because the borders I crossed when I went up to Shetland are somewhat curious. I went up to Shetland, which I haven't been to for years and years and years, and I wanted to hear again the story of the great Selkie from the school skerry.
Ah, right.
Now, for those that don't know this story, and my apologies, I'm getting my apologies in early to anybody from the Shetland Isles in case I get the story wrong, but you have to be told this story by a Shetlander. So, the great Selkie, for those that don't know, in the sea he is a seal, on the land he is a man. Okay, we don't have mermaids in Scotland, we have Selkies. Okay? And so the great Selkie was swimming in the school skerry, which is a stretch of water off the Shetland Isles. And he was looking for another Selkie because he wanted to have a son. And he could not find a Selkie maiden anywhere. And he's swimming away, and there's one evening, it's round about midsummer. So it's very light up in the Shetlands at that time of the year. And he sees this young maiden walking along the shore, and he thinks, oh, she's lovely. So he decides he will go on shore, which he does, and sort of appears out the water. And of course, once he's on the land, he appears as a man. So the young girl just thinks he's been out swimming, and he's quite nice looking, and they have a bit of a kiss and a cuddle, and before you know where they are, they're in bed together. Oh dear me. The next morning, he leaves, and she thinks, oh well, oopsie, but never mind, had a fun night, thinks nothing more of it. Unfortunately for her, she got pregnant. And she spends the next 9 months being scowled at by all the old wifeys in the village because she's pregnant and she won't say who the laddie is.
Yeah.
All the laddies in the village are avoiding her because they don't want to be named, even though they know it isn't them, but they just don't want to be named just in case.
Yeah.
The minister's glaring at her, the usual. But after 9 months, she has a baby boy, a lovely little baby boy with turquoise blue eyes, the colour of the water. And that's fine. And she's really happy that she's got the little baby boy. She's a little disappointed she's not seen the father again. But, you know, life is quite good. And so for the next sort of year, 18 months, she spends, you know, bringing up her little boy. And she finds that he doesn't really sleep very well at night. But what soothes him is to take him down to the shore and let him hear the water.
Yeah.
And then after about 2 years, she's taken the wee boy down to the shore, and as she's got him at the shore, here's the great Selkie coming out of the water. She goes, oh, it's the great love of her life. And he walks up to her, and she's so excited to see him again. And she said, and here is your son. And he takes the little boy, and as he takes the little boy, he says, thank you for my son. Here is your nurse fee. And he hands her a bag of gold, her nurse's fee. And she said, well, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And he said, I'm now going to take my son away with me. She said, you can't take my baby. You can't take my baby. He said, no, he's my child. I have to now teach him to swim the fame. I have to teach him how to swim. And he starts to walk into the water with the child in his arms. And she's terrified the baby's going to drown. And this man she's taking away. She's screaming. He's going, no, it's fine.
So she's been acting like a midwife in a sense.
For the great Selkie.
Yeah.
And as he gets to sort of like waist into the water, he turns. She's hysterical.
Yeah.
And he turns and he said, "Fear not." He said, "You will marry a gunner man. And a right good gunner he will be. But I tell you this, you'd better love him. Because if you don't, ere the first shot he fires, he'll kill my bonnie bairn and me." And at that, the great Selkie dives into the waves. She is utterly distraught, but there's nothing she can do. After a few months, some soldiers come up to the islands on manoeuvres, do whatever it is soldiers do, and indeed she falls in love with a gunner. And he's just about finishing his time in the army, and he finishes up, and he goes with her, and the two of them are married.
Mm-hmm.
And on their wedding night, they have a lovely, lovely night of passion. It's in the summer, but it's very light, it's very bright, and he can't sleep. And he decides to get up and go out hunting. And she's sort of dozing and not quite sure what's going on, but she sort of comes to as he leaves the house and the front door clicks shut. And she sort of comes to and looks, realises he's not there, and then looks to where his gun is, and his gun is gone. She gets up, throws some clothes on, and runs down to the beach. And there he is, standing on the beach, with his gun trained on what looks like a seal and a seal pup.
Ouch.
And as she runs towards him, he fires a shot.
Oh, yeah.
And the bairn and his father, the great Selkie, disappear beneath the waves. And I think that is the most amazing, most poignant, most amazing story I've ever heard. But what I love about it is, what's the border between human and animal? What's the border between land and sea?
Yeah.
What's the border between love and loss?
Mm-hmm.
There are so many layers to that story, and that's what I love about it.
Uh-huh.
The fact that she's a Shetlander, but she doesn't swim, because apparently that was a thing. You didn't, because there was no way you were going to survive in the water, so don't bother to learn to swim, just let yourself drown. Are seals animals? Are they humans? Are they spirits? What are Selkies? What should she have done? Was it in fact all just a dream that she had?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the story absolutely fascinates me, those borders between land and sea.
Yeah.
Myth and reality, legend and history. Here we go again. We've done this before, folks. So that's why I want you to go to Shetland, because of that.
Knut Hamsun, Tales of Love and Loss.
Yes.
Yin and Yang.
Yes.
So in a sense, the story is framing a border.
Yes.
Physical or otherwise, not as a dividing line, but we can view it as a coming together.
Yes,
in a sense,
it's a permeable border.
Let's not allow the border to divide us.
Yes, the border you can pass through in and out that border, and I find it strange that wherever you go in the Shetland Isles, that tale is told, and there are some local variations, but they're almost all identical, and there are so many wonderful songs about it, and. In some cases, it's told as a sort of cautionary tale to young maidens. Yeah, you know, guys appear out of the water, be a bit careful of them, you know.
Be on your guard.
And the thing is, when you go up to Shetland, there are so many seals up there, you can actually walk along the beach there.
Mm.
And if you sing to the seals out in the bay, they will swim in and sing at you. Mm. And I know lots of people will say things like, oh, seals just look like dogs. I don't think they look like dogs. I think they look human. Yes. I think they have human eyes. If you sing to a seal, and I've done it myself, they sing back. Yeah, and if you look into their eyes, I think it's like looking at a person.
Yeah.
Not an animal. I mean, why would, if you sing to, I don't know, go and sing to a giraffe. I don't know, I haven't tried that. But you know what I mean? Why would they bother to sing back? Why would they bother to come close to you when we are by nature, the hunters, the predators of these animals, and yet they are as fascinated by us as we are by them.
And flip that, and you have, it's fascinating because you have the sirens in the Odyssey, and they're using song.
They're using song again,
And the sailors are tying themselves to the mast
to stop it.
To stop being attracted. It's borders.
It's
really
borders
is.
Again, yeah. Yes. I mean, yeah. Mermaids, if you're thinking of mermaids and mermen, which I'm never quite sure about, but, you know, the top half's human and the bottom half's a fish.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is animal, what is human? And but the fact that the Selkies can change from one to the other, I find fascinating. Or is it the fact that they can do that, that they can... Instead of being a human and having to do exciting things like pay your bills and, you know, have a mortgage and have a car and have a job, just go and live like an animal, to be able to shed all of that. Because, you know, with a few exceptions, most people have got exciting things like electricity bills to pay and jobs to do and see to the kids and see to the car and phone up your insurance company and, you know, the exciting rock and roll life that we all live. Wouldn't it be great just to walk away from all of that?
Yeah.
Seals don't have any of that. They
don't have to pay bills.
That's
a wonderful story. And my mind is racing now. Guess what's in my head? Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm getting here, no, we are all beautiful and we are all potentially beasts.
Beasts, yes.
It's not a dividing line.
Yes, yes.
And yet now I have to live in a world of yes or no. Right or wrong?
Oh, yes.
Black or white?
Black or white, yes.
That's why the folktale is so important. Mm-hmm. That is never lost for future generations.
Yeah. And the Selkie, I mean, didn't have a problem. You know, he did not have a problem coming along and having a child with a human woman.
A human being, yeah.
But the child itself, the baby, was a human baby.
The
minute he takes it into the water, it turned into a seal pup.
Yeah.
He was teaching how to swim and teaching and trying to keep safe. Yes. And he warned her.
Mm-hmm.
He warned her about the gunner. He said what the gunner was going to do, and the gunner did.
Yeah.
It killed the child. It killed the seal pup. It killed the Selkie, and it killed the great Selkie as well. Presumably, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They dived below the waves and were never seen again, so we don't quite know what
happened
there.
We don't need
there.
An ending in a sense there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can put whichever ending you want in it, but it's the fact that you can change from one to the other, the fact that the great Selkie could live equally in one world or the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where did the Selkie get the money? Where did he get the gold to pay her? That's always a little bit that rankles with me in that. Where's he got that from?
Well, put that aside.
Yes.
I think about transition. And so much of the folk narrative is about transition.
Yes.
It's really important.
And it's also a transition for her because she goes from being a single girl in the village to being pregnant and being shunned by the village, to then becoming a mother. She's crossed that border. Then she loses her child, so she's mourning that child. Then she becomes a married woman, so she's crossing borders all the way through her life. She's presumably made love with a Selkie, and now she's making love with a human man. So she's crossing borders all over the place, this girl, which is amazing.
For the benefit of the ignorant among us, which would be me, Kelpies and Selkies.
Yes.
Is there any overlap at all?
No.
Water being a theme.
No. Selkies are water. They are seals, and they are predominantly benign. Kelpies are horses and water, and are predominantly malicious. They will drown you.
That's the bit I was missing.
Yes. So Selkies live in the water.
Yeah.
They are seals that can turn into human beings. Kelpies are water spirits. They are horses. They protect the underworld because water is a gateway into the world of the gods because, again, water can be ice or it can be water or it can be steam or it can be... It moves. It's got these mercurial qualities. And it's a gateway to the gods. That's why you throw a votive offering into the gods. That's why we still throw pennies into wishing wells.
Yeah.
But the Kelpies are there to protect the gods. And if you get too close, they will drown you. They will absolutely drown you. Selkies won't drown you. They will swim away from you. They're more afraid of us than we are of them. But no, Kelpies are big, strong horses. If you think of a horse on land, you think of the power of a horse that can kick you. Think of that even larger but in water form.
Yeah, what I was missing was the maliciousness from that, because I've been to the Fokkerquill, where you have these two horse-like installations. It's beautiful, depending on your point of view, this beautiful installation. I had missed the maliciousness of it all.
Yes, yes, and that's Kelpies. Kelpies will, I mean, they're not deliberately, you know, they don't go out and just drown you for no good reason.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you venture too close, they will drown you. Yeah. Whereas if you venture too close to a Selkie, they will just swim away from you.
Yeah, yeah.
They are much more, although the Kelpies, because they are controlled by the underworld, they are controlled by fairyland. As I've spoken before, fairies can be quite
a tad malicious.
Yes, they can be, and unfortunately you can be the wrong person, placing the wrong person at the wrong time.
Yeah.
So you might go out for a swim and then come back, and then I go out for a swim, by the time the Kelpies have got there, it's you they're angry with, but I'm the person that's there, so I'm the person that gets drowned, whereas Selkies will just drift away from you. Mm. And of course the Shetland Islands, people think of the Shetland Islands as if it's one big island. It's not. There are hundreds of little islands up in the Shetlands.
Yeah.
And they are so far north of Scotland, and they're almost in Scandinavia. And again, a border. Are they part of Scotland? Are they part of Scandinavia? Are they a little entity on their own?
I believe, maybe you came across this, I believe that many in that part of the world are considering different forms of governance.
Indeed they are. I think it was Orkney, which is a little bit further north.
That's
again
further north, yeah.
They've had, I think it's a council consultation they're putting out as to whether or not they should stay part of Britain, become like a sort of crown dependency like the Channel Isles, or ask if they could sort of join Norway and become a crown dependency of Norway like the Faroe Isles. I don't know what they're going to decide. But the fact that the local council is having to have a little mini referendum on that shows that there is enough sort of movement, enough of a momentum within people's thoughts that maybe they should be looking at where they are in the world, because they are closer to Scandinavia than they are to Scotland. And they are, I mean, they are miles away. We used to have a joke, for those of you who are not Scottish, if you think of an old-fashioned television set, there used to be a joke that in Scotland you had to have an extra little box sitting on top of your television set so that when the weathermen showed the weather, there would be space for the Orkney and Shetland Isles to be at the top, because they are literally in Scandinavia. These are countries that were given to Scotland by Denmark and Norway as wedding gifts. These are people who go on their Christmas shopping. They go to Bergen or Stavanger. They are so far away from us.
Yeah.
They speak Norn up in these islands, which is a derivation of Scandinavian language. So wasn't a border for them?
One imagines, I could well be wrong, but one imagines the Westminster government would put up less resistance should they decide to seek more autonomy than they would for Scottish independence.
Well, I'm not sure, because there was an awful lot of oil goes in and out of those islands, so maybe the Westminster government wouldn't like them to.
I
don't know, maybe if they became a crown dependency like the Channel Isles and had different tax arrangements, that might actually be better for the Westminster government. They'd make more money out of it.
They can shift their
money
elsewhere.
Who knows? But as I say, I don't know what the people of Shetland and Orkney want. if they want to go and be Scandinavian, which is what I think they are half the time anyway, because it is interesting if you wander about there and you will hear the Orkney and the Shetland accents, which are slightly different but are obviously very northern. And then you'll hear somebody else and you think, oh, that's a very strong Shetland accent. And you realise it's a visitor from Norway or Sweden.
Yeah.
And you think, yep, there are such similarities in there. And if you listen to their folk tales, if you listen to the folk tales of Norway and Sweden and Finland and Denmark, guess what? They've got Selkies as well.
Yes.
So maybe that's where the great Selkie went with the seal pup. Maybe he just swam off north to his northern homeland. who knows?
So we can add to the Turks and Caicos and the Cayman Islands, the rich fat cats can get their money into Orkney.
Well, put it this way, if Shetland and Orkney somehow manage to get themselves back into the European Union, I'm going up there to live. I'm going back up and I will sit there on the beach and tell people stories of the school skiddy and the great Selkie in my Glaswegian accent. So there you go.
Wonderful, Mary.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I hate to do this to you, but I had thought that now that we've spoken about non-linear boundaries and borders, I could maybe spend a few minutes of your time just chatting about a time when physical borders played a big part in my life. I mentioned that I had gone out to work with the Turkish government, if I remember, 1991. Mm-hmm. And at that time, relationships between Greece and Turkey were not particularly healthy.
Okay.
There had been, a few years before that, a Greek soldier shot near the Turkish-Greek border. There was it's almost Falklands-like, there was a dispute over an uninhabited island.
Oh.
Imea? Can't quite remember. Well, they almost came to war. You know, it got to a war footing. Yeah. And we'd had incidents like a Turkish survey ship getting into Greek waters. So I went, the backdrop against which I went, the relationship was not particularly friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mentioned working with or for the Turkish government. But after that Anadolu Gap project ended, the language part, I went back to live in Istanbul and worked freelance for companies like Beko and some of the shipping companies on the Bosphorus. But I lost the protection of the Turkish government in terms of visa, paperwork, and in a sense, I no longer needed a soldier with a gun standing behind me when I was in a local restaurant down in the south. But what that meant was, in order to renew my visa every 6 months, if I remember, I had to leave Turkey and come back in. And on two occasions, I remember, the physical border did make things rather exciting.
Right.
Uh-huh. My first attempt was to travel on what many people would know of as the Midnight Express. Have you seen the movie?
I've seen the film, yes.
Could I point out at this time, when I arrived in, although that movie would have been made in the late 70s, I think, when I arrived and was in Istanbul, there was still this hatred of the movie by almost every Turkish person I met.
Yeah.
Because the depiction of Turkish people in the movie...
Yeah, was so negative.
Was so negative. Yeah. And it had a major impact on the Turkish tourist industry for many years. So from that point of view, there was a lot of anger towards that movie and its focus, especially the Turkish guards and the kids of the guards and the beatings and so on. Anywho, I travelled on what was the Midnight Express, as it were, the train that goes Istanbul-Edirne. And in the past, it crossed very briefly into Greece.
Okay.
So although it was traveling from a Turkish city to a Turkish city, it for a short time passed through Greek territory.
Oh, right, okay.
Now, the whole Midnight Express thing is about, you know, drug cultivation. So what would happen is when it passed into Greek territory, either the Turkish authorities would throw off all the ne'er-do-wells, in Greek territory.
Okay.
Or criminals on the run.
People
whose visa had expired would jump off the train.
Okay.
And then somehow get to somewhere like Thessalonica to get to an embassy.
Okay.
Seek some form of protection. Now, I'm not here to diss the film Midnight Express. You know my views on Hollywood. They sometimes get it wrong. But I undertook that. And I went into Greece to a place called Alexandropolis.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would probably call it Alexandropoli. I don't know. And stayed a few days, soaked up the Greek atmosphere, and then made my way back to Istanbul. But I have to say now, the border crossings were a nightmare. And they were a nightmare for many reasons. I had taken from a place near Edirne a Greek coach to cross the border. And in my naivety, I had taking the first bus I could get a ticket on.
Yeah.
So we had a bunch of Greek people, me and a few others, crossing into Greece on a coach. I don't remember exactly, but I think it took about 4 hours to get across the border. The Turkish guards came on the bus and they threw all the luggage off the bus. We threw all the people off the bus. There was an old man, I remember, who was either a librarian or a bookseller. You'll be interested in that. And he had a suitcase full of books.
Full of books.
Oh, man.
Oh.
So a Turkish guard with the shades, you know, looking really tough.
Yeah.
Kicking the suitcase, opens the suitcase. All the books come out and I'm standing there watching this and they're rifling through all the books and they're what they're looking for, I know not.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps drugs, I don't know. But it was very, very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing seemed, I don't know, it seemed destined to make life as difficult as possible for us trying to cross the border. And as I said, relations between the two countries were not good at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But 4.5 or so hours later, we're able to get back on the bus. Now, the little journey we had made to the border with a bus full of Greek people, it was very somber and solemn. Really.
Yeah.
Nobody was talking. And the minute we eventually got over the border, people started singing.
Right.
People started chatting.
Wow.
Complete joy broke out.
Yeah.
And that was such an important thing for me, that border and what had happened. And a similar thing happened on the way back. I spent a few days in Alexandropolis. And I hate to say this, but when coming through the Turkish border control, I put $20 in my passport when I handed it to the Turkish border guard.
Right.
I had learned living in Turkey
that
if you want things to speed up, that's the way to do
it.
That never sat easy with me,
but
it was almost something that was built in
to the
culture. I had a student, Ahmet Nuri Uz, who was the marketing manager at Beko, you know, the white goods company. He always carried $50 in a separate pocket because he knew that in Istanbul, flash car, he would be pulled over. And in order to speed things up, he would pay the traffic police.
To cross that border, you have to pay a fee.
And so you didn't have to, but it made life easier.
So you got your Norris fee?
But it's always sat quite uneasily with me, if you know what I mean.
The Greek Selkie paid her the Norris fee, that's it. You paid to cross the border. Fee.
Well done, you've linked that.
You know, in some form,
So that was an interesting and at times very frustrating journey.
Yes. And it must, I mean, it must be so difficult for the people who live so close to a border like that.
Yeah.
As you say, you're talking about, you know, everybody being incredibly tense and quite, you know, wondering what's going to happen. And then once you're across that border, a joy breaks out, relief that you've got through the border.
Yeah.
That must be constantly there if you have to cross for work or to see family members again. You know, if you think of she's on shore and the Selkie's in the sea with her baby, if you're on one side of this border, and your family's on the other side, and you know that it's going to take 4 hours and a bribe, and the guards are going to be horrible and nasty, you know, That's a huge tension to have to live with all the time.
And there may be a gunner man
involved. There may be a gunner man who shoots, yes.
It does give one that feeling.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of the Wild West, that area. I believe there's a tri point there now, which is there's a monument of sorts that bears the Bulgarian, the Greek, and the Turkish flag.
Oh, it's one of those ones.
But there are fences in terms of sectioning off the land with the migrant scenario. And I don't imagine one could visit that part of the world without very, very special permission.
Wow.
Again, going back to South Anatolia, I wanted to go to Ararat, Mount Ararat, where famously the Ark landed.
Right.
To the front. That took a long time to get permission to do. So everything were, you know, get permission. And at this point, I have to mention a language participant of mine, Prodromos. Mm-hmm. I mention him by name because although working now in Germany, he was born and raised in Greece.
Okay.
And when we were talking about cultural issues and so on, he gave me such a lot of useful information. He told me about two friends of his who, when doing their military service, mm-hmm. was sent to that part of the world.
Oh, right.
The area where the Midnight Express would have gone through. And that was the extremely short straw for any young person. So there you have it. Having been through that experience, 6 months in Istanbul elapsed pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So I had the bright idea of, instead of going into Greece for a while, a friend and I decided we would cross the border and go into Bulgaria.
Right.
For some reason, we again got to the border. I forgot the name of the crossing point. It's one of the largest borders in Europe.
Okay.
And again, it took forever.
Uh-huh.
But we went inland. Now, I remember saying to my friend Mark, I had recently in the Turkish Daily News, which was the English language newspaper I would read in Istanbul, I had read just a little bit before we took that trip into Bulgaria, an article about some British tourists who had been arrested near an airfield because they'd been taking photographs, as tourists do.
Yeah.
And so I had said to Mark, whatever you do, Don't take photographs. He was a keen amateur photographer.
Yeah.
So we ended up hitching through a village, and we ended up in the middle of nowhere because the plan was stay a while in Bulgaria and then come back in, do the same thing again, back into Turkey. Mm. Mark ignored my advice, was taking some photographs near, I wrote this down because I had kind of forgotten, near a place called, oh, I can't remember. Doesn't matter. Halkali or, well, I don't know. And we were in this very agricultural area. Mm. A truck or a van pulls up and two gendarmes approach us. And we get arrested. Our English or our Turkish doesn't help anyone in the situation.
Okay.
So we're taken to what I presume would have been a police station in Bulgarian terms.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a hovel. And we are questioned in a language we don't understand. Ultimately, what happens is the camera is opened. It's an old-fashioned camera.
Oh, right, to expose the film. Right,
that's destroyed.
Right, yeah.
And one of the guards, I had some Marlboro cigarettes with me. One of the guards in front of me opened every packet and broke every cigarette.
Oh.
I think the pretense may have been they were looking for drugs.
Oh, right.
Or it may have been malevolence.
I thought you were going to say he just took the cigarettes, which I can understand, but okay.
And that broke my heart more than a lot of the frustration involved in border crossings. There's my couple of little stories about a time when a physical border was a real challenge.
It was a real challenge.
But a good learning experience.
Absolutely.
Mary, thank you very much for that.
That
was interesting and informative.
Yeah, on both sides. And I think I shall go away and chase up this lovely Kurdish music that you have now introduced me to.
Yeah, and if we reverse our title, we were blethering about borders.
There we go.
Borders blethering.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye. Bye.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.